Blog Talk Radio.
Home Companion is complete. You're here. Welcome. This is a special day, of course, the summer solstice, the shortest night and the longest day. So we have things to do today. I know that we've been talking about solstice for some time. It's been an ongoing phenomena with human beings from the earliest times, and we think even before that. Today, already, as you know, we're a few hours behind Europe and Britain in particular. 23,000 people showed up at Stonehenge this year. There were only 9 arrests. You know, people do what they do to get carried away. This is a little smaller crowd than the 36,000 that showed up last year, but you know, there was a little bit of cloud, but it's a lot of drum and camera phones, as you can imagine. This is where the visitors leaned on the stones and dancers swirled in the grass and revelers took selfies as part of the celebration. I guess it's a tourist process. There's a big surprise that people were looking for an altered state of mind and using drugs to achieve that state. Of course, in this type of culture, that's considered illegal. And it's been, the celebration, though, is what it is. It's believed to have been an important religious event as early as 4,000 years ago. And it shows a certain, this place, Stonehenge, shows a capacity of the builders that still stretches the imagination. How did they do it? They built the lintels as if they were, you know, the same style that they would if they were putting wood together, and it's hard to just, it's staggering to look at and realize that after 4,000 years it still stands and still has purpose of mind. It brings us into truly into an alignment with the sun, doesn't it? Now, what does that accomplish in the bigger scope of things? Well, that depends largely on you, I think, as it did in all times, to think that everybody was under this under this sway of and the power of this type of celebration. We're going back to a period in the history of mankind when community or tribe were smaller. And the pronouncement of religion perhaps didn't have the options that are available to us today. It's horticultural. The it has horticultural and historic significance attached to it. So, you know, it's are we still swayed by superstition? Well, it depends what you call superstition, my friend. This is we have something called faith that motivates us and soothes the soul. And even the sense of the soul is a matter of a statement of faith. We have obviously a craving to believe in something other than us. The summer solstice occurs when the tilt of the planets axis is either in the northern or southern atmosphere. It is inclined toward the star that it orbits. So we're inclined, where maximum tilt is toward the sun, 23 degrees and 26 minutes. And this happens twice each year, either at the top of the bubble or the bottom of the bubble, and it reaches its highest point in the sky, seen from the north or from the south pole. And it occurs during a hemisphere summer. So this is the northern solstice of the northern hemisphere and the southern solstice of the southern hemisphere. Depends on the shift of the calendar. So this can happen sometime between June 20th and the 22nd in the northern hemisphere, between December 20th and December 23rd in the southern. The sun reaches its highest height, at the moment of solstice, it can be noon only along the longitude, which at that moment lies in the direction of the sun from the pole. Further longitudes, it's not noon. Noon is either past or is yet to come. Hence, the notion of solstice day is useful. A whole day. The term is colloquially used like midsummer to refer to the day on which the solstice occurs. So it has the longest period of daylight, except in the polar regions where daylight is continuous. But worldwide, the interpretation of the events changes according to the culture. And the calendar makes a big difference on this too, of course. But most of us recognize the event in some way, either with a festival or holiday or ritual. Here, you know, we're wrapped pretty tight in this secular environment. We've separated out ourselves from nature as much as we possibly can right now. We've done something very strange. What we're looking at here with the Stonehenge is a time when we were part of nature, where we participated actively that way. We didn't have the self-consciousness about creation, procreation, and death. These were linked spiritually together. Now we don't talk about the sun, the connection of the sun as life-giving. This is considered superstitions and red, you know, even the sophists don't bring that up anymore. In the minds of Masons, I would venture to say, we often consider there's been an incompletion without answers. And the part, at least in this period of time, 4,000 years ago, you think about the person standing there witnessing the sun coming up at this particular time. We know that that was a product of how many years to build that structure. And then think about the amount of the observation of people that determined this point in the year. This was a time when the written word was not available. We didn't have a calendar to calculate. So think about what they were looking at. It was time after time. There wasn't so much of that separation of past, now, and future. But what we had was a sense of repeating. So on this day, the sun comes up on this particular day, as it does on every other day, but it's long. Now, Mark, take away those years when there would be cloud cover, and then think about the consistency that you would need in your observations to be able to determine the engineering of this kind of a location, this type of site. And then add to that the validity of the philosophical, spiritual channel. We don't have that pronounced in our culture. Well, we've long since, you know, what were we looking at, about 435 to 3, well, let's say 323, Greeks would have in Greece made a mighty culture. There was a religious event every single day. There was an act of devotion expected of the citizens of Athens every single day, and sometimes two. But we now look around us and we think, you know, this has become a phenomenon that has passed us by. We are wrapped pretty tight. The country to the south of us, where the pilgrims for a time even banned the celebration of Christmas. Why? Well, you know, it was considered indecorous, perhaps, or an affront to the solemnity reserved for the worship. We're now, when we look at an event, some of us look at and want to understand the connection with the sun, and to understand, I guess, that we could say, you know, that if we extend ourselves as part of that of nature, that and think of our Mother Earth that gives us life. How many times have I heard one or many of you give thanks for what we are fortunate enough to have, and to the whole process that gives us life on this earth. It does, in a way, allow us to stumble into the comfort zone of that comprehension that we are connected, we are all connected, that we are a part of everything, that there's when we look up in the night sky and see the stars, there's a part of that stardust inside of us. We are being penetrated constantly by neutrinos. So there's no that and us. This notion that we are the superior and able to be the master of the universe and master of the environment was more, I think, a product of imperialism or colonialism. It certainly is irrelevant today. We're pretty much clear, I think, that what we're capable of doing is turning our world into a sewer if we don't watch ourselves. And we don't seem to be that clever to be able to stop some of our ruinous ways. Partly, I think, because we've forgotten that we preach a system that to our children that separates the nature around us. Nature, instead of being part of us, is the support system for us. Support system for the necessaries, the things that we are obliged to do to be purposeful in life. And if that's defined by this version of this social economic experiment that we've been in for 100 or so years, well, you know, that's come to a bit of a, we've seen the problems with that experiment. Now we're looking for something else. Major, it's not to say that the world is a terrible place or that we are terrible creatures. We're part of a natural order. Where is this order and balance taking us? I'm not too sure. I like to think that we have people that are capable of looking at longer term trends and understanding the direction that we're returning to, the trends. And maybe this trend is a couple of thousand, maybe it is 4,000 years old. And maybe we are going to become one day worshipers of things that we can depend on, that we can see and know in our minds. And maybe part of that will be a faith. In the meantime, wrapped in this tight nostalgia, wishing that everything would remain the same, seems the work of children. But there we bring out the best in us, and the best in us is what Freemasonry offers. And it's not that it imposes it. My goodness, we wouldn't have these kind of discussions. And hopefully you will find that the opinions that come out of this program are at least qualified, because all of you have wonderful opinions. And every single opinion from every single one of you is absolutely valid and factual, as we know. Everybody speaks the truth in our own minds. So let's presume that we are creatures of habit, limited by our experience. And at least the home Masonic crowd is receptive to the lesson of growth and life and death and renewal and progress that continues on until time is no more. It seems quite almost simple, doesn't it? Let's slide over to the big comfy chair of the topic du jour. We're going to talk today about a little later about Cagliostro, the adoption rite, and Masonic certificate of Agnes Elizabeth von Mendham, just because it's kind of interesting, kind of cool. And we'll talk more about the shift in emphasis here the Home Companion. We're moving toward that notion we're discovering here, always a process of discovery, that Masonry has reached a height unforeseen before. It's continued to progress. We have a new set of dynamics around us, we have some meagerness of thought that is has taken us perhaps a little further away from the direction of Masonry than has been useful for us. We've had a lot of worry about the about stuff that really doesn't matter a whole lot. Somehow, we've even managed to make some of this material tedious and boring. But I like to equate that with the same kind of process that happens when we were schoolboys, and one of our teachers was excited about the material and it took it in a lively and vigorous way, and somebody else could take a wonderful topic like history and suck the every bit of fun out of it. The mathematics teachers that would stumble to get up in the morning and could not convey the excitement about what mathematics did in the process of human development. Those were the people that taught many of us. And so we had very jaded, and often, you know, what we latched onto were the things that we were, quote, good at. It was all, and still is all, a big process of trial and error. It had little to do with the quality, vigor, or ability of the individual child. Very, very little. This was a process that hadn't been done before, and the experiments were done to tweak the system to see if you could get a better outcome. But it's still, the outcome relies on the human spirit and whether you learn how to keep your own counsel, the things that make a good man better. Do we all experience the things that our experiences shape us? Unless you get some rigid-minded little fart that thinks that they were the, you know, the bee's knees when they were born, and some cultures do try to raise their young fellows with that kind of weak-kneed notion, you're left with moments of awareness and understanding. Those, oh, I get it kind of things. Now I see. Now I understand. We learn how to handle disappointments. That first we learn disappointment. Then we learn the crushing blow to ego. Then we learn, or we should. And then we learn how to resolve those kinds of events. Through self-examination, whether our means of compensating are pleasant and mannerly as we think we are, or we're offensive, and then we start to rationalize all of our behaviors, of course. It all just takes the fun out of life and sucks the energy and oxygen out of the room. Let's talk a little bit then about the story of Masonry Revealed. Masonry is a story. Life, I could say to you, think about your life as a story. And what would you focus on? And what would be the essential parts of that life that would make the story unique to you? The story of Freemasonry is not yet complete. It is still unfolding, being revealed in the minds of next generations. You're a next generation. They are our horizon, assuming the torch of opportunity. So many references to so much history, the Age of Enlightenment, the Renaissance, and the Reformation. Scholarship of the ancients, Chinese, Egyptian, and Arabic, seamlessly follow along timelines into our minds. Some ideas catch on. Some become a phenomena. One of them is Masonry. A phenomena that reveals connections between a form of study of intellectual and a good life. It satisfies and pleases at a deep level. It gratifies like the feeling one gets from seeing great art or listening to poetry that expresses the emotion of life. It enlists the imagination in balance with rationalism. It puts forward questions that only the imagination can answer. It links the arts and sciences, past, present, and future. It promotes acts of selflessness, generosity, and authenticity. It admits it is not for everyone. Enigmatic, allegoric, metaphoric, mystery, secret. It is a lifestyle derived from a way of thinking, produced by understanding lessons from history. Life is not a dress rehearsal, and Masonry is the second act. The story of Masonry. We don't have a last chapter to that one. What then? What we seem to often be thinking that we need to tell the stories so they're not forgotten. And here's one that we're going to talk about so that we don't forget. And it helps every time we hear these types of bits of history. We want to know, of course, that we're getting the best history, not the plunk. So when we're hearing about the joy of somebody who's discovered a bit of our history, and they're in their enthusiasm, they skirt over they may be superficial. Well, we want to examine that, because that superficiality passed on begins to cause an erosion within the fabric of Masonry, because we're not getting the quote full picture. It's really important to keep the full picture, the story, accurately told. So we do that by our verbal history. We pass on a great deal of information verbally. Whoever asked yourself why the importance of compliance with a particular form of ritual, as many complaints as there are about that. We see the tweaking of the ritual just a little bit so that it always is using language of the vernacular, because the meaning of words changes. So I think we can all agree that that's necessary. Instead of complaining, you know, the short-sightedness is that they're changing the meaning and changing the intent. Well, you know, I don't think we have a lot of people capable of rewriting a ritual in a way that would have that Masonic hook. But we do have Masons that, and they're very careful, they're not all necessarily scholars. My goodness, when you look at our rank and file, it's not like you proceed on in this meritocracy based on merit alone. Oh my goodness, not quite. There is that knock-on effect of entitlement, and that's part of life around us. People do have that sense of entitlement. We have difficulty with these things because we haven't really looked at them from an ethical point of view. So we struggle, and that's unfortunate. It's terribly unfortunate that such a great organization, such a wonderful opportunity, is distracted by these little things that float by us. But if we're looking at the effect on the direction that we're going in, it's think about being drawn by the forces around us. Think that we are less in charge, in command of our own life, although we may have people that have had some type of command training, so-called command training, that have been brainwashed into thinking that that is actually a form of power. And what we know from Romans, yes, and from the Greeks, that power is ascribed to an individual. The masses, that unwashed group out there, gives power. Nothing else. Nobody assumes it. Nobody has it. But if they can convince those people, a few people can convince the masses that they are in charge, then they are. They've done their job. They've convinced the masses. Always the pendulum comes back. Always, always, always. So look, let's get those people that can tell us about the trends, longer-term trends in thought and in being and in function, to give us some opinions about the direction and the influences on us. I've subscribed to a notion that we're being drawn along, that we twiddle and twaddle with little tiny things that we expect to have enormous impact. Where we're going to have committees of this size, or we're going to have a committee of that size. Well, in the big, long scope of things, it doesn't matter. Good grief. The ideas amongst us will be always at the surface, and that will define us. History will judge us, whether we have contributed in a meaningful way or not, whether we have been good stewards of the craft or not. That's not for you and I to decide. As much as we cling to the life raft that we have, that we now chant, everything's wonderful, everything's happy, everything's wonderful, everything's happy. It is what it is. It's neither wonderful or terrible or happy or sad. It is what it is. The rest is what we make of it. What are these forces that draw us along? Well, think about the material that you're studying and that you really sink your teeth into, and let's call it a so-called Masonic world, although Masonry is a derivative. Everything is, in a sense, derivative. What is original? Certainly not Masonry. It is a derivative of these larger forces that are compelling. Now, as I'm going through this today, I'm thinking about the material, the position that Andrew Hamner took in his wonderful little book on Freemasonry. And really, he's telling us that we need to do away, you know, he was talking about appendant groups being distractions. And, the meta message in what he was writing about seemed to me something like this, that within the walls of the lodge, we can find everything. We can find all of the worth of these appendant groups within the walls of masonry. It requires us to be dedicated to them, to that. Be a dedicated Mason. And remember, he was I'm oversimplifying his thesis, of course, but to me, that was a very, very interesting comment on Freemasonry. And he was implying that we would be a lot happier and unified if we did that. And I applaud his optimism. I don't think that we're such a train wreck, that the appendant groups are more like little chips and they're more like the tail of the comet. But the comet isn't a grand lodge. The comet is created by an amalgam of different forces that are driven by human need, intellectual need, spiritual need. That's the comet. That's the comet itself. Now, the comet is in an orbit. Now, what is that orbit? What creates the shape of that orbit? Different forces. Now, we know that that has to do with powers that can't be seen, but are nevertheless, we're able to be traced in evidence. We can see the effect of these powers and forces. We cannot necessarily see electricity, although I think today we have equipment that allows us to, quote, see electricity, but we can't see the ions coming from the surface of the sun. We can't see it, but it's there. So we know these things. Let's move on then to as you sort out what those influences are in the Masonic epoch. I'm thinking that will help to answer those larger questions about us and universe. In 1833, Thomas Carlyle ruminated that a nimbus of renown and preternatural astonishment envelopes Calistro. Little has changed in the ensuing 180 years in regard to the notoriety of Count Alessandro de Calistro. He was also known as Giuseppe Balsamo said that. Thus, while colorful accounts of the Sicilian adventurer, alchemist, healer, and Freemason continue to fascinate the reading public, no new documentary evidence has emerged over the past century and more to shine any kind of light on the dark clouds of the Cagliostro legend. When faced with a paucity of primary material, the emergence of a previously neglected piece of evidence can be of invaluable help to a historian in terms of casting a shard of revelatory light into the nimbus of renown related to notorious historical personages, such as the case of Cagliostro, with regard to the recent discovery in Russia state military archives of an adoptive right Masonic certificate dated from May 1779 and relating to his residence in the Baltic Duchy of Courland. The certificate provides a rare example of a document signed by the infamous adventurer as Grand Master of the Lodge. The certificate records the initiation of the Baltic noblewoman Agnes Elizabeth von Meidem, the third wife of the Freemason Count Johann Friedrich von Meidem, into the degree of Mistress of Écossais Masonry. The significance of this document is considerable, as it ranks as the earliest direct proof of Cagliostro's activities during his restless peripatetic life. The certificate also provides an invaluable source for re-examining Cagliostro's links to European Freemasonry. Of particular importance in this regard is the fact that the certificate provides the first evidence relating to Cagliostro's embrace of adoptive Freemasonry, which included women, at a time when this mixed gender right was burgeoning among the aristocracy of many European countries. The study of adoptive right Masonry, Freemasonry, and its place within the wider parameters of 18th century aristocratic associational culture is currently enjoying something of a long overdue boom. Consequently, in drawing on recent research, this article will highlight how the Masonic certificate in the archives in Russia reveals Kaliostros as having initially embraced key elements of Old Testament symbolism commonly associated with the adoptive rite at the time. Prior to this, a brief study of Agnes Elizabeth von Medem, to whom the certificate was awarded, will be undertaken. First, however, we'll follow an analysis of the evidence of the certificate linking Kaliostro's adoptive lodge to the strict observance rite. A link. Kaliostro and the strict observance. In his description, the 19th century Masonic historian Albert Mackay remarked, "This appellation is derived from the fact that every female or adoptive lodge is obliged by the regulations of the association to be, as it were, adopted by and thus placed under the guardianship of some regular lodge of Masons. Moreover, members of the male lodge that had sanctioned the adoptive right lodge could participate in the latter, hereby, in effect, making it a mixed sphere of association rather than, as Mackay suggests, a female-only place." The opening lines of the transcript of the adoptive certificate from the Russian state military archives in Moscow reveals that Kaliostro's new lodge in Metal conformed to this adoptive practice. We learn, for example, that Masons of Les Loges Trois Épées Couronnées, the Lodge of Three Crowned Swords, had collaborated with Kaliostro in forming the Lodge of the Three Crowned Hearts. Thus, while Kaliostro had been installed as the Grand Master of the Lodge, the certificate indicates that two other prominent Masons of the Lodge of the Three Crowned Swords, Otto Hermann von Hauen and Johann Gotthard Korff, served as the Grand Inspector and Secretary, respectively. Evidence that the Masons of the Three Crowned Swords in Metau sanctioned the foundation of an affiliated mixed-sex lodge is highly significant. First, the Lodge of the Three Crowned Hearts ranks as the first known adoptive lodge in Courland and the surrounding Baltic area. However, arguably of more importance is the fact that the certificate provides a documented example of the establishment of an adoptive lodge directly affiliated to a St. John's lodge of the Rite of Strict Observance. Hitherto, no such concrete evidence has linked strict observance Freemasonry with a working adoptive lodge. The Rite of Strict Observance has a high-grade form of Templar Freemasonry that flourished in German-speaking areas, in particular between the 1750s and the 1782, when the order was disbanded by a special convent held in Wilhelmsbad. The driving force behind the development and growth and popularity of the strict observance rites was Baron Karl Gotthard von Hund. By the time of his death, von Hund had succeeded in creating a form of high-grade Freemasonry that strongly appealed to conservative noblemen in German-speaking areas of Europe and beyond. This appeal was based on a seductive mix of chivalric Templar mythology and the tantalizing prospects of advancing toward theosophical and alchemical knowledge. Ooh, my. That would be an interesting discussion. Let's see what happens with that. Furthermore, the mystique of the strict observance was heightened by the promotion of an elusive ruling elite, the so-called unknown superiors, whose binding decrees were conveyed by Van Hund. Yet, until recently, no historians had so seriously connected the strict observance rite with the spectacular growth of the adoptive rite in the 1760s and the 1770s. However, in 2008, Andreas Onofors published an article that asks, was there a female branch of the strict observance? In reply, Onofors draws on a previously unknown manuscript dating from September 1773. Now, those of you who, out there who have been students of the Sankey lectures will know that our friend, Brother Andreas Onofors, was the first, of the death of his good friend. Andreas stepped in and did the first Sankey lecture when his good friend passed away after committing to do it. Lovely, lovely man, Grand Lodge of Sweden. A very, very interesting academic, esoteric, and a complete gentleman. In reply, Onofors he's putting out the question, was there a female branch of the strict observance? And you and I will know the strict observance if you've attended in Bath, Ontario. You've had the pleasure of being given permission to attend. That it is the contemplative experience of Freemasonry that many of us have been seeking inside of the lodges around Ontario. It is a remarkable experience. He then refers to a manuscript from September 1773, which outlines the project submitted to Baron von Hund by a fellow named Christian E.F. von Vichum Eichstätt, a Sicilian member of the strict observance, regarding the foundation of a Mycosine de Dans. While there is no evidence then von Vichum and Eichstätt's project ever came to fruition, it does reveal a climate in which members of the strict observance were countenancing the acceptance of a mixed-sex rite. Indeed, if one is to believe the thinly veiled accusations of the anonymously written The Life of Joseph Balsamo, I'll spell that for you in case you're wanting to check that out, Balsamo, The Life of Joseph Balsamo, published in the Apostolic Chamber of Rome in 1791. Cagliostro himself successfully and lavishly promoted his own brand of Egyptian Rite adoptive Freemasonry as a host of strict observant lodges across continental Europe. In this work, it is stated that a certain George Cofton first conveyed the Egyptian system of Freemasonry to Cagliostro in London. Henceforth, in 1777, Cagliostro repaired to The Hague, where he was invited to assist at one of the Dutch lodges, the members of which were exceedingly strict in the observance of their ceremonial. In this lodge, Cagliostro allegedly presided over meetings as Grand Master and pronounced an eulogium in Egyptian Masonry, after which he was requested to found a lodge for women. Consequently, he received into it many ladies of rank and fortune as members. His wife filled the office of Grand Mistress. It is written that Cagliostro then visited Venice, Nuremberg, Berlin, Leipzig, Danzig, Königsberg, before arriving in the Courland capital. In Leipzig, in particular, the author describes how Cagliostro acquired a high celebrity and renown among Freemasons on account of his pretended discoveries of the Hermetic art. The veracity of this work, however, is dubious at best, as the account is drawn from information gleaned while Cagliostro was being interrogated by the Inquisition. Moreover, the Catholic Church was intent on sullying the reputation of the adventurer as a heretical necromancer and Freemason. In short, the life of Joseph Balsamo provides a highly unreliable source on which to judge Cagliostro's Masonic activity. Hence, the adoptive right certificate of the Russian state military archives throws invaluable light on the nature of Cagliostro's early Masonic activities, especially given the utter dearth of evidence regarding his connection to strict observance Freemasonry and the order's dalliance with the adoptive right prior to his arrival in Courland. Crucially, the detailed memoirs of Alicia van der Eyck, a founding member of Cagliostro's adoptive lodge and the daughter of Johann Friedrich von Medem, allow the historian to contextualize the certificate within the close-knit Aristotic milieu of Natal. Thus, from von der Eyck's memoirs, we know that the Lodge of the Three Crowned Hearts was founded on 29th of March 1779, only around a month after Cagliostro's arrival in Natal. Founding members included a host of eminent Courland dignitaries who were members of the Lodge of Three Crowned Swords. Indeed, many of the initial male members of the adoptive lodge were Knights Templar. That is, they had reached the sixth and highest degree of the Rite of Strict Observance. On reaching this lofty status within the Strict Observance, each Mason was granted a knightly name along with a coat of arms and motto. Thus, Elisha's uncle, Christoph Dietrich Jorg van Medem, who was Grand Master of the St. John's Lodge, as well as being the Marshal of the Nobility in Courland and a Supreme Counselor, was known as Ecce de Tetraton Majori. Her father, Johann Rietek van Medem, went by the name Equus Aquaria, while Otto von Holland's strict observance moniker was Equus Cadelabro Majore. A certain notary named Herr Heinz is also cited by von der Eyck, who was in all likelihood the publisher Jacob Friedrich Heinz. He too was a Knight Templar who had been awarded the name of Ecu et Satori. In fact, of the male founding members of the adoptive lodge, only Major J.G. Korff and Cagliostro himself were not listed in Carl Jacobi's membership roster. However, this does not mean that they had not attained the station and stature of Knight Templar, since the record was drawn up 2 or 3 years prior to the opening of the adoptive lodge. Van der Eyck notes that our lodge was founded by Cagliostro with the support of these brothers. Moreover, she crucially adds, that my aunt, Anna van Medem, my cousin, Louise van Medem, and I were elected sisters. We'll finish up with this tidy tale, but it gives us hope, a bit of perspective on this unanswered question. There's a challenge out there that it still comes that is interesting for a group of people with a claim to an intellectual fabric try to ignore. What about women? And the simplistic outcome of that, we either get up off our ass and onto our feet and protest madly without giving a shred of discussion, because the feebleness of, because that's the way it's always been done, isn't true. There's a broader, much more enriched discussion that needs to take place about the whys. Yes, there are some clear, serious reasons why, and that's what needs to be brought up. Not this, sometimes I've heard Masons give an answer that's been childishly salacious, and it's been embarrassing. But otherwise, it is a question that needs to be drawn forward. But do we have the courage, the collective courage, to do it, I'd say not yet. Not here, not yet. But I digress, which I'm prone to doing. So this is a remarkable day here. You've heard what day of the year it is. This is summer solstice, the 172nd day of the year. I hope you're getting ready for the New Year's celebrations. They're only 193 days away. Today, it's a. I'm hoping that the sun comes out. I'm just about ready for another cup of tea. And then I think I'm going to get out my Jimmy Buffett margarita maker and kickstart that little puppy and see what it can produce. Of course, today's theme being sunshine and me being a product of my age, I've got some peppy little music I think you'll like. It's all about the sunshine theme. I hope you liked the program today. I've really enjoyed having you here. Talking about things Masonic is always enlightening and amazing. This topic around women, you know, and rubbing up against the orbit of strict observance lodges based on new evidence and is, I think, a product of our times. We should prepare ourselves for some things that may redefine our thinking. Our historians are quite good, and be they boy or girl, the historians, the academics are digging into this topic. And no doubt, if you can think this way, of course, we will all find benefit from new findings that help refine with some greater degree of precision the history of the order and the events surrounding it. And some of that may change our thinking, not only subtly, but with some drama. Prepare yourself. Of course, it's not a hard step for a Freemason to remain open-minded. Meanwhile, while you're out there committing those acts of random Masonic kindnesses, I hope that you're finding life as rewarding as ever. And that you've found your Masonic influences as satisfying as you can imagine. Here we're going to talk about morning and sunshine, and I'll look forward to seeing you again real soon. Bye. Oh.
I hope I don't get fried. Shot, two shot. Forever.